Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101 and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that has no trouble laughing at itself, which is preferable to our taking things too seriously. We are, after all, talking about movies, not issues of universal import. Laughter, or the attempt to evoke such, is on the slate today as we tackle two very different movies. One, a documentary, the other, a narrative film that reflect individual senses of humor. George Carlin's American Dream is a two-part, three-and-a-half-hour look at the late Carlin's life and career. Fire Island, on the other hand, follows the exploits of a band of gay friends as they make their annual summer trek to New York's famed Barrier Island. Let's begin with a look at a man who changed the face of American comedy. It's not easy to adjust your comedy act. Just ask any number of today's stand-up stars, from Kathy Griffin to Dave Chappelle, both of whom who have had trouble with so-called cancel culture. George Carlin, who died in 2008 at age 71, is a model for how to adjust to changing times and tastes. As co-directors Judd Apatow and Michael Bonfiglio show in their HBO documentary George Carlin's American Dream, Carlin began as a suit and tie wearing comic on TV variety shows before transforming himself into a bearded, long-haired star of the alternative scene. But then, as a third act, Carlin became a popular social critic, willing to skewer those in power with his razor-sharp wit while still making his audience laugh, even if so often somehow uncomfortably. Apatow, no comic slouch himself, and Bonfiglio show us Carlin's roots from his New York childhood through his off-troubled marriage and inveterate drug use, while having a number of others, from comics such as Bill Burr and Jerry Seinfeld to friends and family members, comment as well. The result is a comprehensive look at a one-of-a-kind comedy classic. Some might even employ that overused term, genius.
And you mentioned Judd Apatow, who's one of the directors on this project. And I would say that he has redeemed himself, because earlier this year he made a Netflix movie called The Bubble that's one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. And now he comes around and makes this really great documentary. I was really taken by this and devoured it pretty quickly, despite it being, you know, nearly 4 hours long. But what I loved about this was that you got the full trajectory of Carlin's career, which was a lot more tumultuous than even I knew. I mean, I knew about the different phases of his career, that he started in kind of clean-cut variety TV land, and he was making fun of sort of counterculture types with his hippy-dippy weatherman character. And then he became kind of a hippy-dippy character himself when, you know, he really put his own beliefs and political ideals front and center in his material. And then he kind of had a falling off in terms of his cool factor in the late 70s, early 80s, came back again. You know, it was just a roller coaster for him, which I wasn't really aware of, because now we speak of him with such reverence. I mean, mm-hmm. If you look up lists of greatest stand-up comics of all time, it's usually him or Richard Pryor are number one. They usually jockey for that spot. And Pryor is also a tertiary character here, because they came up around the same time and had a similar rocky road to success. But what makes this a great documentary and not just a hagiography with all of these comedians sitting around and talking about how great and transcendent George Carlin is, as true as that may be, we get a lot of his material, because there's just this wealth of archival footage that the directors have to work with.
From all these different variations.
Yeah, uh-huh. You see him on TV in the 60s, and you see, you know, like camcorder footage of him trying out new material in the early 2000s. So it runs the gamut. And I just love how you'll hear someone in Carlin's sphere, whether it's one of his contemporaries or someone he inspired, or even his manager and agent who were in this as well, talk about how he put material together. And then Apatow and Bonfiglio just show us an entire routine. So we'll get 5 uninterrupted minutes of George Carlin's material. And obviously you can get that anywhere. You can go on YouTube, or, you know, every few months one of his stand-up routines goes viral because he was talking about things 35, 40 years ago that are sadly still relevant today. But I really appreciated that. I love the fact that it wasn't just about the content of the material. It was about how he put the material together, how he paced it, mm-hmm. how he structured a comedy special. And when you have, you know, 3.5 hours to work through this stuff, why not show it? And I thought that even going beyond, you know, showing the darker parts of his life and career, I just thought it did a really great job of dealing with Carlin the person, but also Carlin the artist, mm-hmm. And how he worked and how he functioned. So, yeah, I thought this was really terrific. And even though I thought I knew quite a bit about George Carlin, I learned a lot from this as well. well.
And I would say the same, because he was sort of a ubiquitous presence in his various incarnations throughout my entire life. And so it was great to see the way that this was put together. I can't imagine editing this particular film. I liked the fact that his daughter was sort of the continuous thread throughout. And at first, I was a little annoyed by that. But I think that she did bring this perspective, obviously, of the personal part. But also, she was a through commentator on the arc of his career. And so that was something that I thought was really beneficial that this documentary did that others don't. The other thing is, the thing that I find so amusing, ironic, whatever, today is people from all walks of life across the political spectrum are coming back to George Carlin and, you know, sort of focusing on his type of comedy and so
claiming
forth and
they
so
know
on.
What he meant, yes.
Right. Yeah. And I think he was unabashedly liberal progressive, you know, in almost every way. So
and got more so the older
right,
he got.
Right, don't you think? Mm-hmm. Yes, and some of us can appreciate that as well.
But he just didn't trust groups. One of the great scenes is him talking with, I think it's Charlie Rose, and he's talking about he loves individuals, he loves people, but when they become in groups of 5, 10, or even 2, you know, they start becoming something else completely, and he distrusts that completely.
And the irony of that being that his career rests on the fact that he's entertaining large groups
of people.
And
yes.
if
and
they don't show up to see
do
him,
that.
He has no
right.
career.
Well,
yeah.
and the other thing that I liked about this doc is here we are on HBO, and he sort of became the initial guinea pig and focus for these HBO comedy
mm-hmm.
specials.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always a little conflicted. So should we go see this person in person, or should I wait for it to come around? And, you know, you can't always sit in the second row. And part of George Carlin's mystique is the funny faces that he makes and these sort of like fake awe and angst that he expresses. And so I think he is the perfect individual to showcase in an HBO format because we can see him. We can see the physicality of his comedy. We can see his quips. We can see his fake outrage and his genuine outrage. And
especially because his later stuff, and maybe that's one of, if I had to criticize George Carlin, I would say that as a stand-up comedian, well, he really kind of stopped being a stand-up comedian
correct.
After a while. He, like, his late stuff, even though there are comic bits in it, he was kind of doing a one-man show, almost like a TED Talk about, here's what I think about the state of the world and everything that's wrong with it.
That's right.
And sometimes you wouldn't laugh necessarily. You would just kind of sit in awe of the way that he was delivering this material with this rapid-fire
yep.
pacing and just this way of thinking that he was always two steps ahead of you. And I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about this documentary and someone quoted Carlin where they said, and they kind of talk about this in the documentary, George Carlin's American Dream, where someone said, you know, you get the audience to think about things. And he said, oh, I hope not. I want the audience to watch me think. And I thought that was a really interesting
wow.
way of putting it. And I think you see the opposing ideas of that in this, where you see Chris Rock being interviewed and he says, you know, comedians are the modern day philosophers. And then it hard cuts to Jerry Seinfeld
going,
saying, that's a load of crap.
Like, yeah,
we're,
yeah.
we're just supposed to go up there and make people laugh. And I think George Carlin kind of towed that line where he was able to sort of do both. And I feel like nobody that has come after him has really been able to
nail it
in
the same way.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. One of the things that George Carlin's American Dream shows really well is the process by which he transformed from this kid in New York, a kid with a very judgmental mother, a kid with no father, who became the class clown, and he transformed from that all the way through. And just his use of words and everything that he displayed early on so well, he never lost that. I mean, even when later on he became a social critic and was standing there talking about it's a club and you're not in it, mm-hmm. you know, even then he was using words and talking about the meaning and about communication. It was really brilliant stuff. And the other thing I wanted to mention was it's a trope dating back to Mark Twain, in which old guys ultimately become grumpy old men and they just hate everything. And I think Carlin can be accused of that. But he did it with such intelligence, and he did make it funny at certain points. We may have laughed uncomfortably, but we were still laughing.
But what this documentary shows is that that might have been true of his work, but not his personal life. Because the sort of the coda of this movie is about, you know, after his first wife dies and he remarries and he kind of finds, you know, this new age philosophy that he embraces, which I didn't know about at all. And so that was a side of George Carlin I didn't know. You also talk about his use of words. I mean, his use of dirty words, and specifically words you can't say on this very medium, not only kind of revolutionary in the way that he was making us examine what obscenity even means, but it became the subject of an obscenity trial itself. So, and that whole chapter could be its own documentary in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
because after teaching that particular case, it was really intriguing to me to see the sort of behind-the-scenes sausage-making aspect of it.
And that was George Carlin's American Dream. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Fire Island. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
An 11th commandment. In 20 years, people would be shocked to learn that there had once been only 10, and wouldn't care if there had been.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the documentary George Carlin's American Dream. Let's now move to the narrative romantic comedy Fire Island. There are only so many plots for movie makers to follow, but if you were to use the work of a writer as a template, the novels of Jane Austen would be a good choice. That's what screenwriter and actor Joel Kim Booster did for his film Fire Island, which was directed by Andrew Ahn. Loosely, very loosely, based on Austen's Pride and Prejudice, Fire Island features Booster as Noah, a perpetually late New Yorker who, along with a gaggle of friends, heads to the Big Apple's Barrier Island for their annual summer gathering. Turns out this will be the last gathering, as House Mother Erin, played by Margaret Cho, will be selling her island home. While trying to get his best friend Howie, played by SNL cast member Bowen Yang, set up, so to speak, with a romantic partner, Noah finds himself attracted to, repelled by Will, played by Conrad Riccamora. You can guess the rest. Fire Island may not be particularly original, but its cast, especially Booster and Yang, do boast decent comic chops. And the main strength of the film? It has gay characters defining themselves as opposed to the many, many times they've been lampooned by mainstream movie makers.
The highlight of Fire Island is the sweetness at its core. And I think that that does simultaneously reflect and reject Pride and Prejudice, at least the Jane Austen incarnation that we're most familiar with, that we've seen on screen in
numerous adaptations,
really, play out in various ways with various people we recognize and don't recognize. So I thought flipping the script and making this a commentary on sort of gay culture and the hierarchies within the gay community was really brilliant. And I'm not sure it always worked, because sometimes these sort of witty quips and the repartee among the characters feels a little forced, at least it did to me on occasion. But for the most part, this is just a fun movie. I mean, it's a fun summer movie. If you're familiar with Fire Island, and we get some sort of inside information about where the men go, where the women go, what that looks like. And I really laughed at various points throughout Fire Island. It's, of course, aided by the performances. I didn't recognize the one character immediately who plays a lawyer named Will, Conrad Riccamora. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, he's from How to Get Away with Murder.
He's a Broadway guy, too,
yes,
I think, isn't he?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, and I think that Bowen Yang from Saturday Night Live was super charming. And then, of course, we have our primary protagonist, played by Joel Kim Booster. And I really enjoyed his character, too.
Yeah, and I think the movie that we could probably most aptly compare this to is Clueless, which was another kind of reimagining of a Jane Austen novel. In that case, it was Emma and mm-hmm. transplanted to, you know, 90s SoCal. This is doing a similar thing. In fact, this movie references Clueless.
Yes, it does.
Kind of a tip of the cap. And Joel Kim Booster, who's the star, also wrote this movie. I agree with you. I think it's a pretty smart idea to take these themes and kind of turn them inside out through this prism. And, I mean, you have all of the familiar plot beats that are associated with Jane Austen, but also the millions of romances and rom-coms that it inspired. You have, you know, the couple who don't like each other at first, and you know they're just destined to fall in love eventually. And you have the falling out between friends, and you have the dramatic confrontation
the
in the rain.
Misunderstanding about,
and
who's
you have
who.
The last-minute mad dash to catch the guy before he leaves. You have all of that. And the movie is obviously self-aware. It knows what it's doing. You know, so I think this works as a reimagining of romantic comedy tropes, but also kind of an appreciation of romantic comedy tropes. And I agree with you, MP, that this movie, Fire Island, does a good job of giving us a sense of Fire Island as a place. Like, this definitely has the familiarity and knowledge of a lived-in experience. And it's also examining, I think it's a little more sophisticated in its themes than maybe you're giving it credit for, because it's dealing with the racism that these guys face and the microaggressions
and elite,
they face.
Elitism, social class.
Well, and the class thing is obviously right out of Jane Austen, too. This idea that the only reason they can go to Fire Island for vacation is their friend has a house they can crash at, and she only has a house because she won the lottery, and even then she probably won't have the house for much longer. So it's dealing with that, but then it's also dealing with the fact that most of these characters are men of color and they're just not treated in the same way. Even though Joel Kim Booster is beautiful, he's still not being treated the same way as his white counterpart. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in this movie, but beyond anything else, I just thought it was really funny and really charming. Like some big laugh out loud moments in this, courtesy of this cast and Joel Kim Booster's script.
Yeah. Well, and I think Yang and Booster together are a good combo.
Because they have great chemistry.
Yeah, they seem like unlikely friends and perfect friends at the same time, which is why that works.
Well, let's face it, Bowen Yang is really an underused talent, even on Saturday Night Live, where he is one of the stars. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would love to see him get his own vehicle, although this is pretty close to that, because he gets a lot of good scenes. He gets some dramatic moments, too.
Right.
He's so funny.
So we've been talking in the show about comedy. So what else do we want to say about comedy? We were talking in the first half about George Carlin, and now we're talking about a romantic comedy featuring gay characters.
And some of them were comedians, you know.
Like stand-up
comedians. Absolutely. Joel Kim Booster, I'm not really familiar with him, but now I want to seek him out.
Yeah, he has a few stand-up specials, not as many as George Carlin.
Right.
Well, I was just thinking this morning, as we were preparing for the show, that we've seen so many stand-up comedians over the years try and make that transition to the screen, whether it be TV or movies. And in fact, there's a running thread in the Carlin documentary about his attempts to be an actor.
And to be Danny Kaye.
And his network sitcom, The George Carlin Show, which only ran for a season, I think. And he even admits, we see him in an interview on, I think it's Larry King Live, saying like, me and network TV just did not gel.
Really?
And so I was just thinking about that concept, that idea of going from stand-up to movies. And it seems like a natural progression, but they're totally different art forms.
No, absolutely. And what's interesting, what Mary Pat and I noticed, was that one of the people who were talking about that transition and why it doesn't work was Jerry Seinfeld. He was talking about, I don't want to work with other people. I don't want to collaborate. I want it just to be all about me. And then Mary Pat points out, wait a second, weren't you on the show, Seinfeld?
one of the most popular shows ever?
Yes, exactly.
Well, but I think that kind of prickliness works in the context of a show like Seinfeld, which in retrospect, I mean, it's one of my favorite shows. I've seen it a million times. But that is a show that really probably shouldn't have been as popular as it was because it is about these characters that all hate other people. And so Jerry Seinfeld being sort of a curmudgeon kind of works within that context. And it helps that he had someone like Larry David who probably hates people even more than Jerry Seinfeld does.
As evidenced by his particular show.
Right. Well, but we were talking a little bit before about this beforehand, and you pointed out that one of the most successful transitioners from individual stand-up comedy. I mean, he basically got his start in stand-up comedy, but then went to television, went back to stand-up comedy, and then ended up winning an Oscar for Good Will Hunting. And we're talking about Robin Williams.
Well, and I think that his journey from the stand-up stage to TV and then to movies was a little rocky, although, you know, he became a pretty big star relatively quickly. But if you go back and watch some of his early movies, even in stuff like Dead Poets Society, where he's playing an English teacher, he's still doing stand-up routines as Robin Williams.
Right. It's almost like we expected that, and if we didn't get it, we'd be
disappointed.
What?
And so he would play characters like the DJ in Good Morning Vietnam, or his character in Mrs. Doubtfire, who's like a voiceover artist slash comedian, which made it possible for him to, in quote-unquote, in character, do these routines. And I think once he got comfortable as an actor, because he was such a great dramatic actor and was deserving of that Academy Award, he was able, I think, to be more comfortable on camera, not as Robin Williams the comedian, but Robin Williams the actor. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that a lot of comedians have a hard time with, because even though you're ostensibly yourself as a stand-up comedian, you're still, you have a persona.
That's
you're
right.
adopting a character.
Think of Mike Myers. I mean, Mike Myers in every one of his, he has to be a persona, has to be what he was on Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. And when he is that, for example, in, is it Wayne's World?
Or Austin Powers.
Or Austin Powers. He's great. But if he steps out that, although he was good in Studio 54, remember?
Oh, yeah.
That
yeah.
movie? I thought he was really good in that movie.
Well, and then we have people that maybe the small screen doesn't exactly know how to deal with them. I'm thinking of Martin Short. I mean, he had sort of a rough.
So talented.
He was very talented. But then now he's having like a third incarnation, only Murders in the Building.
Yeah.
Like, who would have predicted that?
Well, I loved him as Jiminy Glick back in the day. But that you almost didn't know that was Martin Short because he was buried under makeup. I guess you're saying that you don't love the movie Clifford then.
No.
Okay.
What? Tell us about Clifford. How does that work into this overall oeuvre of comedy?
Well, that'll be on next week's show. I'll continue this dissertation on Clifford.
Okay. And that's all for this week's version of Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinman and Rampat Truthart and I discussed George Carlin's American Dream and the romantic comedy Fire Island. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot, on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember these words from, of course, George Carlin. If it's true that our species is alone in the universe, then I'd have to say the universe aimed rather low and settled for very little. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.